Blog Talk Radio.
Planet Earth. Well, you know. Well, wait a minute. Washington, D.C., United States of America, Planet Earth, third planet from the sun. I'm your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones. And we got a lot to talk about because I've been gone. I didn't do the show on Friday and was planning to do a show on Saturday, but I got caught up with some travel issues. And but now we're back, and we want to get this party started. First off, I want to get over to this, start with this story about, I want to talk about Barack Obama, and I want to talk about hope and change. And when do I not talk about Barack Obama? Let's just keep it real. All right. First off, on Saturday, Washington, D.C. celebrated Barack Obama's finally reaching the big 6-0. Of course, we're not talking about his age, which is alleged to be 49, but his 60th game of golf since taking office. That's right. He has had 60 golf games since taking office, and he's been really, really busy. While England contemplated establishing a no-fly zone to protect violence-torn Libya, and Harry Reid was declaring that no agreements could be made on budget cuts in Washington, and Michael Moore was proclaiming the beginning of a socialist revolution in Wisconsin, and while dozens of people in Louisiana were being killed by violent weather, which will really, really be hard to blame on George Bush, the alleged president pulled on his checkered knickers and hideous tam shirt and hit the links again. He really knows how to live, doesn't he? I mean, talk about giving folks, a president, a bad name. He took an environmentally questionable motorcade of 10 cars, each filled with paid government employees, to the Andrews Air Force Base golf course for his standard 5-hour game, during which time he presumably actually had to be decisive enough to choose between a wood and an iron. Because there's no golf club called present. And I mean that when I state that, I mean that while the alleged president, Barack Obama, was in the state house in Illinois, he voted present 67% of the time, as opposed to an actual yay or nay vote. And while in the Senate in Washington, he voted present 48% of the time instead of an actual yes or no, up or down vote. While in office, President George Bush also enjoyed playing golf, let's be fair, but he gave it up in 2003. He stated, and I quote, "I don't want some mom whose son may have recently died to see the commander-in-chief playing golf," end quote. Once again, quote, "I feel I owe it to the families to be in solidarity as best I can with them, and I think playing golf during a war just sends the wrong signal." Now, whatever you may think of George W., he was a leader. He was a man of compassion, a man who understood the real world. We think Barack Obama's habitual golfing during times of national and international crisis certainly does send a bad signal. But in this case, one that is perfectly accurate. He is a 9-to-5, Monday through Friday government worker who can't be fired and certainly won't accept a cutback in perks. So here we once again have a president of the United States who, well, he hangs out on the links. Well, while there are earthquakes happening, pillaging, plundering, death, destruction everywhere, while the world goes to hell in a handbasket, well, Barack Obama hits the links. After all, he's got to get that golf game in because he has such a stressful job while he's doing absolutely nothing. So, wow. I mean, are we kidding? The world is going to hell, and dude needs to get on the links because, wow, his job is so stressful. Let's play a brief clip here of what's really going on when we talk about Obama's friends and Obama's enemies. Because apparently Obama, as he clearly stated during the healthcare debate, has a friends and enemies list when he suggested that, hey, don't think we, and I quote, Don't think we're not keeping score, end quote. Those are actual words of the president himself. So apparently he's keeping score, and we have a clip here of Obama's friends and enemies, and basically it encapsulates what I'm about to play, just speaks to the train wreck, our own personal earthquake, our own personal national disaster, which certainly shouldn't be equated with what's going on in Japan right now. Our hearts and our heartfelt everything goes out to those folks. I wish I could go take some time and go and help and do whatever I can. But I know that all that can be done is being done. But I don't mean to equate Barack Obama's presidency with what's going on in Japan, although arguing that he is the Antichrist and these things are supposed to happen in the 7-year reign. Well, we can argue that another day. But here's a clip: Barack Obama, 2 years in office. It's really, really good, and it really does speak to what's happening.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Firewall. I'm Bill Whittle.
Bill Whittle,
you know,
Firewall.
There comes a point where no matter how hard you try to offer the benefit of the doubt, evidence builds up to such a degree that you can no longer deny that the evidence is trying to tell you something. And halfway through his first term, the foreign policy decisions made by Barack Obama and his administration are so appalling, so destructive in the long term, that they can no longer be credited to inexperience or even incompetence. They're so consistent that they must be due to ideology. Now, some of you are old enough, as I am, to remember life during the Cold War. Well, the final stroke that shattered the Soviet Union came from a steelworkers union in the Polish town of Gdansk. It was called Solidarity, and the raw personal courage of its leader, Lech Walesa, and the immediate and unwavering moral support given by two champions of human decency and freedom, Polish Pope John Paul II and United States President Ronald Reagan. Poland became the first and greatest of former adversaries turned into ardent pro-West, pro-democracy countries. But after decades of research and billions of dollars, and not long after the Russian invasion of former Soviet satellite Georgia, President Obama canceled a working missile defense that was to have been based in Poland. He did it to appease the country, which divided Poland with the Nazis in 1939, that would be Russia, and he did it on the 70th anniversary to the day of the German invasion of that country. That is a mortal insult to a brave people and a stalwart ally. In Honduras, another American ally in a sea of socialism and dictators, the ruling Honduran president tried extra-constitutional measures to extend his term, a move rejected by the Honduran courts and also by the Honduran people. But the Obama administration ignored this and essentially said they would not do business again with the Hondurans unless the proto-dictator was reseated. Now on to Israel, the only Western country in the most volatile region of the world. First, Vice President Biden starts an international incident by exploding over the fact that a developer in Jerusalem, Israel's capital city, remember, simply wanted to build more units on existing property. Obama and his administration turned it into a crisis about expanding settlements. Later, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, being officially received at the White House, was not allowed to enter through the front door, but rather had to come in through the rear, like a house servant. The president of the United States dictated his conditions to one of our closest allies, and when the Israeli prime minister began to discuss these ultimatums, President Obama told him to work it out with his low-level advisors, as he was off to have dinner with Mrs. Obama. Now, that is astonishing in the degree of studied, intentional, diplomatic insult and humiliation. That's not an accident or inexperience or even incompetence. You know, wars have been fought over less than that. And on now, of course, to Britain. We talk about a special relationship between Britain and America. Well, that's because there is a special relationship between Britain and America. We've had a special relationship since at least World War I, where American soldiers in their thousands went to their death to help their British allies, where American and British troops bloodied the beaches of Normandy, where untold thousands of British soldiers fought and died under American command, and vice versa, where Churchill and Roosevelt and later Truman had to balance their shared values to defeat not only Hitler, but also Japan and their erstwhile ally in Joseph Stalin and the aggressive communist monolith he would go on to lead. You know, the British gift to the first African-American president was a magnificent penholder made from the timbers of HMS Gannet, a Victorian-era anti-slavery ship. In exchange for this exquisitely sensitive and thoughtful token, President Obama gave the British Prime Minister a 25-disc DVD collection of Hollywood movies, which is unwatchable in the UK anyway due to format differences. Queen Victoria gave to all American presidents a magnificent desk made from the timbers of HMS Resolute. I've seen pictures of President Obama sitting at that desk, but the narcissist in chief provided Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II with a $150 piece of consumer electronics, an iPod. It's the kind of thing you can buy in a vending machine in an airport if you're in a real hurry. But this one, of course, was made immortal and priceless by the inclusion of various speeches given by Barack Obama for the Queen to reflect upon and draw wisdom from. Oh, and Queen Elizabeth already owned an iPod. Barack Obama, to my knowledge, did not already own a Resolute desk. At a session of the United Nations in New York, the British Prime Minister pursued the President of the United States on a matter of pressing urgency, and the President hustled from room to room like a rock star, avoiding an annoying autograph request. A spokesman for Obama's State Department told a collection of British diplomats, quote, "There's nothing special about Britain. You're just the same as the other 190 countries in the world. You shouldn't expect special treatment." Well, we didn't get the example of the Magna Carta from Ecuador We didn't learn respect for the rule of law from Uzbekistan. We didn't get the idea of the presumption of innocence from Thailand or any of the other bedrock institutions and values that built America. We didn't get them from Luxembourg or Chad or Portugal or Korea. We got them from Great Britain. None of this compares to the recent announcement from the Obama administration that, in stark contrast to the help given Margaret Thatcher by Ronald Reagan in Britain's 1982 defense of the Falkland Islands, this time America would remain neutral should Argentina try to give the invasion another go, which makes it just a little more likely, doesn't it? Or the fact that the President of the United States of America gave to the Russians, over strenuous, almost incredulous British protests, the actual serial numbers of the U.S. Trident missiles sold to Great Britain. KGB spies were presumably prepared to die to get this information, but Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, handed these secrets to the Russians over the protests of our closest ally so that he could get a START treaty with Russia to help his sagging poll numbers at home. Well, that's how he treats our allies. How does he treat our enemies? Well, he shakes hands and smiles with brutal Venezuelan dictator Hugo Chavez. He sides with Venezuela and Cuba, another brutal dictatorship, against our allies, Colombia and Honduras. He campaigned on having no conditions, high-level meetings with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the rabid, barking mad dictator of a country, Iran, that is responsible for virtually all of the ongoing acts of terror leveled against the United States since they declared war on America in 1979, and which grows daily closer to developing and using an atomic bomb. In Afghanistan, President Obama has made it clear to the Taliban that they will not be crushed as the Iraqi insurgents were under George Bush's surge, but will rather simply have to run out the clock until some arbitrary date for our publicly scheduled retreat in shame and defeat. He bows to Saudi princes. He praises the mullahs against the protesters giving their lives for freedom in the streets of Tehran as they are shot dead trying to topple our mortal enemy. And instead of using the influence of his office to pressure Egyptian President Mubarak on freedom from day one, he instead mangles the situation in such a way that no ally we have in the world has the slightest confidence in us whatsoever. And finally, the boy who was raised in Indonesia can return as a man and as president to the land of his childhood, where Israelis are not allowed to set foot in country, where, in some provinces anyway, Sharia courts allow stoning to death for adultery, where 100 lashes with a whip is meted out for the crime of homosexuality, where female circumcision is practiced openly, where so-called honor mutilations go unpunished if not celebrated, and where political and religious repression exist that would boggle the American mind and say, with his megawatt smile, that Indonesia and America are bound together by, quote, shared values. America does not share Indonesia's values, Mr. President. America's and Britain's and Canada's and Australia's and Israel's core values are usually antithetical to what Indonesia practices with impunity every single day. But Iran and Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and China, on the other hand, and all the rest of those enemies of freedom that you get so cozy with, do not share America's core values either. And the tide of evidence lifts me almost daily to the disgraceful conclusion that while they don't share America's core values, perhaps they share some of yours.
That was
keep these messages coming. Go to DeclarationEntertainment.com and become a citizen producer. We'll see you next time on The Firewall.
That's The Firewall with Bill Whittle on Right Network. You know, is there any need for me to even finish this show? No, because you know what? Here's the mistake I made. I played this audio clip, well, it's actually a video, of Bill Whittle basically putting together this disaster of what Barack Obama's presidency has been up till now, and there's still almost 2 years left on his term. And if I'm going to talk about Barack Obama for the next 40 minutes, well, what left is there to say? I'm either going to have to hang up the show for the night or just talk about something else. Because, I mean, he just put it all together. He put it all together. He said it all. There's nothing left to say. This is what happens when you put a guy in office who has no idea what he's doing. Okay. Now, let's move on, because I can't talk about Barack Obama much anymore because he just said it all. The next topic is, it's come to my attention that as Americans, we really haven't been at the top of our other Earth citizens' Christmas list for some time now. Like some spouse that has become too used to having her good life paid for by a husband's work and sweat. You keep telling us that you need your space. So I've listened and I've heard. You want your space and we're ready to give it to you. Politely, if possible, but with both barrels if necessary, so pay attention. We gave you a lot during the last 65 years. Since VJ Day, in terms of direct aid, whole oceans of cash and special privileges. But we didn't complain. There was the Marshall Plan, the continuing defense of Europe during the Cold War. While you just sucked down bonbons and took long hot showers in the wee hours of the morning, with every misfit Muslim, Serb, or what have you that came your way, with a handful of gimmies and a mouth full of not so much obliged, we looked the other way because we didn't need those images seared into our collective memories as Americans. And then there were all sorts of loans never paid back, and many billions and billions more in private charity and donations, above and beyond what our government has done for you with our tax money. You were wimpy, and we were Popeye. But our metrosexuals loved summering in the province countryside and writing hymns to your culture, theme parks. So, well, what the hell? Don't even talk about the cost of maintaining a credible defense all across Europe so you didn't get munched up and torn down with blueberries by the Soviet bear, looking a little testy again, isn't he? Alas, none of this was enough for you. Like some teenage stoner with an unlimited American Express card, you always needed more. You always had to go for one more deep suck off the bong. That's bong. I meant to say bong. And while flipping us the finger, even when your own economies were robust enough to give you 30-hour work weeks and a whole month off in August or July, we still couldn't pony up enough to keep you in beer, Skittles, pistachios, and fromage, whatever the hell fromage is. This situation has made us poorer than we would otherwise have been. There are a lot of things here at home we could have spent the money on: schools, infrastructure, scholarships, lower taxes, you know, that kind of thing. And the kind of local American charities that always need help, such as grossly underfunded, well, you can send Al Sharpton a ball gag, or you can move on. We hope you'll understand when we say we need just a year or so of working the charity begins at home concept in order to catch up. And frankly, things are a little tight over here, and we need to cut back on luxuries such as, well, you. It's almost more than a little depressing to wake up every morning and find UN intellectuals in the New York Times blathering on and on about how stingy and uncaring Americans are. Hence, Americans are taking the few years off, not only to save many, many billions, trillions of dollars, but for a time of reflection and boasting of the old self-esteem. After all, you can't help others unless you feel good about yourself. So, UN General Assembly, United Nations, we're going to take a little time off. Perhaps you can get along without us for just a little while. Just a little while. Because we're tired of spending considerable amounts of money only to be told that we can just go straight to hell. And that's my take on what's going on with the UN and the UN General Assembly. So, moving right along. I was reading an article earlier today about in American Solutions, and it boasts the top three myths in Obama's lecture on gas prices. And as is the description of our show tonight, we want to talk about gasoline prices and the many distortions that the administration has put out there for us to the fat about. President Obama held a press conference on March 11th in order to discuss rising gasoline and oil prices. Gasoline at the pump now, if you haven't noticed, averages around $3.50, $3.75 a gallon nationwide. And experts around the country project prices to eclipse more than $4, sometimes upwards of $5 a gallon. And that's a fact. Possibly by the beginning of the summer driving season. But instead of providing a solution that most Americans want, more domestic drilling, President Obama used his presser to recite misleading talking points to justify his anti-energy policies, arguments that have all been thoroughly debunked. But apparently, our would-be president thinks that we're all just plain old stupid, that we're just not bright enough to really understand. So he can just throw any lie out there and distort the facts and the figures. And hey, well, the American people, you know, I'm the president. I won. Well, here are the three biggest myths from President Obama's remarks on March 11. He went on to state that we can't escape the fact that we control only 2% of the world's oil. Well, this is a common refrain among anti-drilling Democrats and environmentalists. And it is repeated enough that many people accept it as true, like most things. Say, play it again, Sam. Now, as most of us know, Bogey never said, play it again, Sam, in the movie Casablanca. But it's been repeated enough times that a lot of us will do a Bogey and we'll say, play it again, Sam. But he never said that. And Cagney never said, you dirty rat. And worst of all, Elvis never did say, the only thing a inn can do for me is shine my shoes. That's one of my pet peeves right there. because I'm a big Elvis fan. But, you know, I digress. Moving right along. So, I guess if you repeat, we can't escape the fact, or that we control only 2% of the world's oil, then I guess you, I got a bridge over here in the Francis Scott Key Bridge is up for sale. I'll give it to you for $50. But it's repeated enough. In reality, it's 100% false. Not the fact that I own this Francis Scott Key Bridge. Well, that too, but the fact that we control 2% of the world's oil. It's 100% false. The number comes from a highly conservative estimate from the Energy Information Administration. And up until the other day, I had no idea that there was such a thing. Totaling Americans' proven reserves where we are already drilling. It does not include the 10 billion barrels available in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It does not include most of the 86 billion barrels available offshore in the outer continental shelf, most of which President Obama has placed under an executive drilling ban. And, oh yeah, and it does not include the 800 billion barrels of oil we have locked in shale in Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. Those shale resources alone are actually three times larger than the proven reserves of Saudi Arabia. So the claim that the U.S. only has 2% of the world's oil is clearly false, but liberals will go ahead and throw it out there. And Obama has done the same thing. Now, isn't he supposed to be brilliant? Or is he just conning us, like the good con artist we have known him to be over the last 2 years? The next big Obama lie. Here it comes. Industry holds leases of tens of millions of acres, both offshore and on land, where they aren't producing a thing. Those are Obama's exact words. President Obama adds to this whopper, this blatant lie, because we're all like, duh, Homer Simpson. Because, you know, folks are going about their business, buying their groceries at Walmart and just chilling. And then, you know, he'll throw it out there, and it, because he's the president, you know, it's got to be true, right? Well, President Obama told this lie by saying he wants to encourage companies to produce on the leases they hold. Now, while this sounds like a good common sense fix, it actually just blind rhetoric reserved only for people with a shocking ignorance of drilling. Because you can read between the lines. But it basically boils down to this. A lease for exploration and production, not just production. You need both. And because oil is not equally distributed across the globe, one parcel of leased acreage may not hold any oil. Moreover, due to the needlessly complicated permitting process, it can take years for companies who own a lease to complete their exploration. And to get to the production phase, it could take as long as 10 years. Ironically, President Obama wants to tax companies for not producing on their leases, even if the federal government refuses to grant permits as the reason why those companies are not drilling. Isn't any of that make any sense to you? But here, once again, this is what happens when we elect an empty suit whose slogan was, yes, we can, and hope and change. Okay. Yeah, we were desperate, weren't we, as Americans? Was America desperate when they elected this fool? Now, let's move on to lap number three here. Last year, our oil production reached its highest level in 7 years. Can you say, liar, liar, pants on fire? This is pure spin right here. President Obama is deliberately trying to take credit for action unrelated to his own policies. The increased level of production is due to the actions of previous administrations, and production in the Dakotas, well, where most drilling is occurring on private land, has nothing to do with the Obama administration. By contrast, the Energy Information Administration projects that there will be a decline in production of 220,000 barrels of domestic oil per day in 2011 alone and in 2012. In 2012, America will produce 150 million fewer barrels in the Gulf of Mexico, all because of President Obama's policies to discourage or ban domestic drilling. In addition, President Obama's drilling moratorium and subsequent refusal to issue drilling permits has forced at least 7 rigs to leave the Gulf and sign contracts with other countries, taking much-needed jobs and revenue with them. So, to put it all in perspective, as gas prices skyrocket, or necessarily skyrocket, Americans are reminded every day that the federal government's refusal to allow responsible domestic drilling can have an incredibly destructive economic impact. And instead of trying to fix this problem, the Obama administration has worked every day, every single day, to make sure that America produces less oil and has to rely more on OPEC for our energy needs. None, mind you, of White House spin or misleading talking points can change these tragic facts that I just laid out for you. I mean, let's keep it real. Now, let's listen to Dana Perino.
Gas prices can make or break elections. There's no doubt about it. And what's interesting to me is how the administration allows President Obama to say things that are so quickly proven false. He stood at the press conference on Friday saying, well, my policy has been great, and I'm actually encouraging production. And you said things like, but that can't possibly be true. And it doesn't matter. Production is up this year, but it's in spite of President Obama's policies, not because of. This takes 10 or more years to develop, so President Clinton even agrees on Friday. Almost at the same time President Obama is speaking, President Clinton is saying it's ridiculous to continue the moratorium in the Gulf. And so I don't think it's so much partisan as, if you go into America where you are on a fixed budget and gas prices go up and you have to decide on whether or not you're going to be able to put money towards X or Y, maybe that means you don't go on a family trip or something like that, it does make a huge difference. And a lot of small businesses, very small margins of profit, and gas prices are a big deal to them. And that's why I think the White House is trying to get in front of this. But the facts are standing in the way of their rhetoric.
Well said, Dana. Well said. And is she not one beautiful woman? I mean, come on, really. I'm telling you right now, I have a big crush on that woman. She's just my type. But moving right along. What's next? Come on. Is this guy a mess? I mean, come on. You can't make this stuff up. Some folks will say to me, "Hey, why are you always talking about Obama? I mean, why don't you talk about what's going on in Libya? Why don't you talk about what's going on in Africa? Why don't you talk about what's going on in Japan?" Well, this guy's right here at home. I mean, what's going on in other countries is very, very important to me. No, there's no doubt about that. In In respect to the fact that I am a historian and I am and my history, my inquisitive nature with regard to history is worldwide, not just here in America. But this guy is right here, and everything that he does affects, apparently, is affecting me directly and you too. And so he is at the top of the list when you want to talk about anything that's going on in the world, because he is, in fact, for now, a world leader. He doesn't lead. He doesn't know how to lead. That's been obvious and painfully so for the last 2 years. However, he is the crown jewel and the architect of all the mischief that's going on in the world, whether it's can be directly attributed to his tenure as president or indirectly. Now, since the November elections, we heard innumerable references to 1994 and 1982, these well-worn narratives that, you know, like Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan before him. That Barack Obama can rally from midterm losses to recapture voters and win re-election. We've heard the comparisons between Reagan and Bill Clinton's time in office. There's just one problem. There's just one tiny little problem. Most of the breaks, especially recently, are going against our would-be president. Yes. 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 It's early still. And no, we haven't the faintest idea who will be the GOP nominee. But the emerging issues, the things we weren't even talking about 4 months ago, such as gas prices, Mideast revolutions and government unions, they're shifting the political ground in ways that don't bode well for Obama, despite what you hear from his acolytes. Now, to be fair, the economy finally appears to have stabilized. The national employment rate in February fell below 9%. The first time it has broken that barrier in almost 2 years. It all be good news for the president if inflation didn't threaten to sabotage these gains. Now, gas prices in particular have shot up by more than 40 cents a gallon, as we stated earlier, nationally during the past month. And the reasons are varied, but it's been easy for the Republicans to point to Obama's clampdown on new deep water drilling permits since last year's BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Obama spoke the other day about increasing both production and conservation, that he had acknowledged before that higher energy prices are crucial to his environmental policies. Remember that electricity would necessarily skyrocket. Well, I believe that Obama would like for gas prices to necessarily skyrocket so that we may turn to electric cars or other means of environmentally friendly transportation. But he misjudges the American people. We like our automobiles. And you can have our gasoline-powered automobiles when you pry our hands, our cold, dead fingers off the steering wheels. But he doesn't understand that. And then one big factor in rising oil prices lately has been unrest in the Middle East, as we can see every single day by watching Fox News. We report, you decide, fair and balanced. Middle East and North Africa is boiling over. The news isn't good for Obama. From Egypt to Iran to Libya, the president has always seemed off balance, out of step, and disengaged. He seems to be completely uninterested. as he spends the day 5 hours on the links. You're the president of the United States. Tesla, you're the president of the United States. Conservative TNT, you're the president of the United States. Folks in the chat room and listening on your computers, you're the president of the United States. The world is boiling over. Earthquakes, pillaging, plundering, death, destruction, famine, all of that. Would you head out to the links for a 5-hour game of golf? Would you? Can you say poor judgment? Or would you just say, I don't give a damn what's going on. I'm headed out to the golf course, and I'm going to get my 18 holes in. And I'm taking 10-car motorcade with me, smoking up the place, and a whole host of high-paid government workers to go and watch me play and do nothing while I play golf all day. Because that's a good way to spend taxpayer money and a good way for me to get a little exercise while the whole world goes to hell all around me. Because, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Hosni Mubarak is our man in Egypt. No. He should leave. Gradually? No. He should go now. We stand with Libyans who want freedom, but only figuratively, unless NATO or the United Nations thinks it's a good idea. But, you know, hey, I'm on the golf course, in which case we'll contribute. Well, yeah, oh, maybe. Unless it looks like, Muammar Gaddafi will survive after all, and in which case, or that arms embargo we signed prevents us from helping rebels. Do I need a wood or an 8-iron? Maybe. No, can I say present? Can I just respond? No. Uprisings in faraway lands are tough to gauge and impossible to manage from the outside. But Obama hasn't even articulated a consistent message on American ideals and interests because, frankly, he don't give a damn. But he'll bear some blame for that when things eventually go poorly. Even if they turn out well, and that's unlikely to happen, throughout the region, I stayed out of the way isn't gonna work. That's not going to fly, because basically what he's been saying is, I stayed out of the way and let the other country handle their business. The United States of America should not be getting involved with other folks' problems, and that we're not kingmakers here. Okay, all right. Between his reaction to the uprisings and his belated decision to resume military trials for terrorist suspects at Guantanamo Bay, Obama has managed to make himself severely vulnerable, to my great delight and perhaps yours, to hawks on the right as well as doves on the left. And that's no mean feat, folks. And then, of course, there's the sudden fierce debate about collective bargaining for public workers. The cherry on top of the pie. And that issue has swept across much of the Midwest. And then Obama, as just as dumb as he is, openly backs the unions, while conservatives have rallied behind the GOP governors who are pushing the matter fiercely and bravely. As we continue to debate public sector pensions and budget deficits, I suspect independents will favor the right approach, which is the right approach. Get it? Right, left, conservative, liberal. Yeah, okay. Finally, we have the icing on the cake, Obamacare. We knew the health law would be politically relevant in 2012, but the expedited appeal of a Florida court ruling striking it down means its fate might be decided by the Supreme Court by the summer of 2012. After that, the odds of fixing the law, if it's struck down, or repealing it if it survives, will be longer. The losing side will be deflated. Stay tuned, because at the way things are going right now, the deflated side will be Obama's side. Yeah. Did you hear that the president said that it would be easier if he were president of China? Mr. Obama is right. It would be easier to be the president of China. Because if you're the president of China, people around the world who are fighting for freedom don't really expect you to help. If you're the president of China, you don't have to put up with annoying off-year congressional elections and then negotiate your budget with a bunch of gun and religious clinging congressmen and senators. If you're president of China, you can fund your national public radio to your heart's content. And if you're president of China, when you host a conference on bullying in schools, people will take you seriously. Unfortunately for you, Mr. Obama, you're the president of the United States. And unfortunately for us, you're the president of the United States. And that job brings with it certain special responsibililities. It's a tough job not to be taken lightly and spent on the golf course for 5 hours while the whole wide world goes to hell in a handbasket. This job is tougher than being president of China. But Barack Obama ran for the presidency of the United States. Maybe he should start behaving as the president of the United States. Or maybe he would like to see the United States become much like China. Now, President Obama held a news conference on March 11, 2011. And I'm reading an article right now titled Spectator in Chief, and I thought it would be interesting to read over the air right now. President Obama held a news conference today, which would be March 11, and assured Americans that he is monitoring gas prices, Gaddafi, and budget negotiations, leaving many people wondering what exactly he was actually doing about these issues, which have been boiling for weeks. Hey, have a good night, conservative TNT. Obama said authorities would monitor any possible manipulation in the oil market and said he'd ask Holder to monitor for price gouging. He offered a vague promise that his administration was encouraging offshore exploration and production, but quickly quoted wealthy wind energy investor T. Boone Pickens. Is that really his name? This is one emergency we can't drill our way out of. Wow, what great wisdom. Quoting T. Boone, Obama claimed last year American oil production reached its highest level since 2003, but Republicans counter that U.S. oil production is below where it was projected to be just a few years ago, and that where there was growth, the administration is taking credit for production stemming from leases that predated this White House. So is anyone surprised that Obama would take credit for something that he really didn't have anything to do with? And moreover, when asked whether he was concerned Gaddafi may have the firepower to defeat the rebels, Obama responded, "I am concerned, absolutely. The world is watching." Oh, my God. Obama, you're the one watching and golfing and chilling and throwing parties. What an embarrassment this dude is. Obama said, the world is watching. Obama also added that NATO is having a series of conversations that include 24-hour surveillance so that we can monitor the situation on the ground. He insists that we are slowly tightening the noose on Gaddafi, but offered little evidence how. Of course not. And before I go, because it's 21:54, I want to just mention this whole idea of lowering standards for police officers. Holder has put out an edict that we should lower standards for police officers. Exams so that a D is the same as an F. So that more black candidates will qualify to become police officers. That is goddamn embarrassing to me right now. I mean, please forgive my foul mouth, but that is embarrassing. So apparently we don't have any black folks who are smart enough to pass a police exam. Because apparently, according to Eric Holder, well, we ain't caught up enough. You know, those bad schools or whatever, the whole thing about the 60s and how we weren't taught to be as smart as white folk. Or maybe he wants to go back to slavery days when it was illegal for us to read. And so that's why, you know, it's taken a couple of hundred years for us to catch up in the reading department because we weren't allowed to read 400 years ago. And so since we're just now learning how to read, the exam is just too advanced for us poor black folk. And we should really, you know, we should lower our standards. America should lower its standards for its police officers so that just any old yahoo can get the job. Eric Holder is a moron, too. Here's the thing. I lived in Miami in the early 80s. And then again in the early 90s. And the city of Miami was having a very difficult time finding police officers. So they lowered their standards immeasurably. They lowered their standards so low that officers who could barely speak English, I'm talking about criminals who came off the boats from Cuba. They got off the boats and they were allowed to apply to become police officers. We didn't know whether they were criminals or not at the time. Because they just couldn't find good officers. And there were not enough blacks and not enough Hispanics. There were mostly white officers. So the standards were lowered to impossible levels where almost anybody could become a police officer. And in fact, there were many felons who wound up on the force because those standards had to be lowered to get more ethnic folk on the force. So what occurred was riots. Because cops didn't do their jobs right. There were there was a situation where a cop shot a guy on a motorcycle because he thought the motorcycle guy was going to run him down, so he shot him, which resulted in riots all over Overtown and Liberty City and downtown Miami. It was a big old mess because you had officers who couldn't even speak English. All I could understand from the guy while he was on trial was, "I fear for my life." That's all he could say in English. Otherwise, he couldn't barely speak English. But he was allowed to carry a gun on the streets of Miami because of then the beginnings of political correctness. That's a problem. So now the show's over. I got to go. I really, really do appreciate all my listeners out there. Thank you, Tesla, for coming in. Thank Conservative TNT. I really do appreciate it. Y'all have a great evening. Love you. Hey, Tesla, I'll be listening to your show. And, hey, have a great evening. Thank you so much. All right. I am out.
message home before it gets too frightening. We ought to call a halt. So could we start again, please?
I'd be living to see you, dying to see you, but it shouldn't be like this. This was unexpected. What do I